amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show, probably the only finance-related podcast run by not one, but two ETB Level 2 qualified coaches. It's been a really interesting week in markets and finance this week. Joining me to talk about it is Steve D. It's been a week where the Diageo share price fell 15% after the company issued a profits warning. Jerome Powell frightened everybody in the markets, and the UK managed to avoid a recession by bumping along with flatlining growth. But we're not here to talk about any of those things. We're here to talk about far more interesting and important things. But before we get to them, Steve, how's your week been? How are you doing?
Not too bad, Steve. In terms of stocks, we've had a very decent week, to be honest with you. I have beaten the market quite handily again. Despite having a dodgy Friday, the market went up about 2%, and I certainly didn't. But I'm up about 3.56% on the week. The market is up about what it did on Friday, because it started off a little bit flat, and then had a good day Tuesday, down on Wednesday, and then recovered Thursday, Friday. So I'm beating it quite comfortably because I had good days every day this week. So that's good. Happy with that. Adyen, obviously, which we'll try and discuss a little bit later, has driven the vast majority of that performance, jumping about 35 or 40% on the week, I think it is. So that's been good. And I've seen a lot of people on Trading 212 communities celebrating that one, Steve, and crediting us with it somehow. And I mean, all we're doing is just reading the news back to people. So I feel like, you know, nobody credits Trevor McDonald for reading the news. So, but yeah, we're happy
to take it, Steve. It's been a while since you watched any news by the sound of it.
Yeah, I was going to say, is he still the newsman?
I don't think he's still the newsman, no.
Is he not? No. So tea tonight, Steve, going out for Argentinian Grill. It is time that I repay the window cleaner, seeing as on Netflix don't let me share the password with him. So I've decided to take him out for a steak instead. He's not just my window cleaner, to be fair. He used to be the captain of our cricket team, but that's not
say,
as funny.
You should stop referring to your wife like that, but sure.
It's not as funny to refer to, because I like the shock horror of saying, yeah, I just pay my window cleaner with Netflix. But yeah, he was the old cricket captain at our club, so... So yeah, we're going out to an Argentinian grill, Steve. We've actually been out there a few times, so it's really looking forward to it. They do probably the best mixed grill I've ever had in my life, and it is just a mixed grill where they say we're going to mix this with different types of steak and different cuts of steak, and then a Creole sausage, which is absolutely blow your balls off hot. But looking forward to it. How's your week been, Steve?
It's been all right. No one's blowing my balls off just at the moment, so congratulations on that one for the evening. Enjoy your evening with the window cleaner. But yeah, if anyone else is interested in Hull's best mixed grill, Steve will be there, well, yesterday now, I think, assuming you're not flagging this ahead because we're going out on Sunday. But it's been a quite a chaotic week here, to be honest. Market-wise, it's been broadly similar shape to what you described, up pretty much all of those days, and coming out slightly further ahead than the US market, but with less of a push on the Friday than they got. But that is what it is. The game doesn't end now for me particularly. There's still time for me to get further ahead, or the US market to get ahead of me. I'm not sure whether I'm ahead or behind for this year, to be honest. I must be behind. I'm not as heavy into big tech as they are. So when the time comes in a month or so to start trying to build a money-weighted spreadsheet that tells me what I've done for this year and how I've performed relative to other things, because we always put that in the end of year review, I suspect it's going to be not good. Or it's going to be behind, in my case. I'm not terribly worried about that, but I strongly suspect I'm behind overall, but with an outperforming week, oh well. Outside of the markets, things have been kind of all right. It's been fairly chaotic, but then some dickhead sent me a message earlier this week to say that his baby's heartbeat was fast, so he'd had to whiz into hospital. And then he didn't send me another message for about 2 hours while I was wondering how he was getting on. Next thing he told me was to say that Adyen's going nuts after an investor presentation. I was like, never mind that. We've got other things to be worrying about at the moment. Is everything well, Steve, with your family?
Yes, everything is well. I think it was basically, so my wife was at the midwives this week, and they had a student midwife, and she said that, Laura said she was quite heavy-handed. Obviously, she was taped up because they were listening to the baby's heartbeat at the same time. And when they were pressing her, her heartbeat rose quite considerably, sort of from sort of 120. It's like an old steam train, which sounds a lot for people, but about 120 to sort of 150 is fairly, seems fairly normal for a baby from what we understand. But this rose to like 160 to 180. So they were really worried. So my wife went back to the day unit, which we spoke about the other week, where she stayed for 7 hours and didn't get treated. So she was dreading it. She actually couldn't even get a parking space, Steve, at the hospital because that was so full of people. So she was dreading it even more. She ended up having to park at the train station and walk in, which was about, it's about a mile walk, which for somebody who is, what, 36 weeks pregnant, is that's quite a walk. But yeah, got in and seen immediately and out within 30 minutes. Basically, the midwife said, well, if it spikes, I can't deal with it. So then we ended up having to see a consultant who sort of came in, looked at the papers and went, there's nothing wrong. You don't need to be here. Please go home. And
good.
That was that?
Then all is well, and we can get on to the things that we've been consuming this week. Steve, what have you consumed this week? Anything interesting or good, or just the usual?
Yeah, before we do that, Matt on Spotify asked us if he could have a copy of our discount cash flow calculator. Well, Brian Froldy's discount cash flow calculator that I have repurposed to be useful. Matt, I can't reply to you on Spotify for whatever reason. Spotify haven't actually built that function yet. So just to let you know, it'll be in the description of either the video or the podcast this week. So if you need it still, it's going to be there for you. In terms of consumption, Steve, I really struggled this week. And the secret here is because we actually recorded a show midweek and that's coming out a bit later. And I used up my consumption, the thing, because it was 2 hours long and it took me ages to get through. I used up my consumption for the week, but I did stumble across two very, very interesting things. So I spotted that Chip, the savings app, was crowdfunding. On Crowdcube at the moment, so that might be an interesting opportunity for people to get shares in a fairly fast growing business. If you've got your savings with Chip and you like Chip, then that might be an interesting thing for you to, you know, go and have a look through the pitch deck and see the sort of numbers that they're generating. But the other one I spotted, Steve, was CarWow, and I don't know if you've ever come across that, but if anybody was interested in reviewing cars or you know, just seeing what car you're going to get next, CarWow often comes up in the YouTube feed as the car review, and they're actually crowdfunding as well. They've got an interesting little business tacked on the back of it. And for full disclosure, the three things I'm going to talk about today, I own shares in all of them. But yeah, CarWow is an interesting one that I think I'd quite like to double down on. Maybe get, because I only have about 100 quid in it, to be brutally honest. But yeah, that's an interesting company to definitely look through the pitch deck. And the third thing, Steve, that I stumbled across was I got asked if I would test the new Monzo cashback feature.
Oh, and, you're testing this. Cool. Yes. I've seen it advertised. I've seen it very highly praised as well. And I'm waiting for it to be rolled out in my direction.
It is very, very generous. So it's not like Chase. So it's not like you're getting 1% blanket cashback on absolutely everything. Basically, what happens is they send you a big bunch of offers. And if you take advantage of those offers, they give you a kickback. So it's more like using a Quidco or something like that. But normally, these Quidcos, they've normally not got the sort of places you want to go to. Well, straight up off the bat, you get Asda and you get 5% cashback when you spend 40 quid. So that's a pretty good deal, especially for somebody who's like Asda is literally just a couple of miles down the road there, and I literally have to go every week. So, but there's also Boots, Deliveroo, eBay, H&M, National Express, Krispy Kreme, Disney Plus, Currys. So there's some decent little companies there. Foot Locker, Steve, if you're in that, Virgin Trains, if you're into that, LNER. So all of the things that I think the vast majority of Monzo users probably use on a fairly regular basis are there to earn decent cashback. Some of them, like Foot Locker, you're getting 10% back. If you go to Yo Sushi, you get 8% back. Use Gusto, Steve, you get 10% back. These are pretty decent returns.
They do sound like pretty decent returns. And one of the things I saw about the Monzo selling points for this was it was saying not random stuff, stuff that you actually kind of use. Because Amex does cashback and has done for a while and is in some ways kind of almost synonymous with the idea. But their cashback things tend to be on the small side and they tend to be in... Well, I was going to say tend to be in fairly sort of strongly discretionary things that I don't discretionarily choose, which is fine. I'm sure they're good for, I guess I'm not really a kind of traditional Amex customer. If you think that they're typically people with higher net worths and so on, that isn't really me. But I'm interested in some of these that you mentioned. Asda sounds like it's kind of offsetting the effects of inflation for you then, assuming they're passing through price increases with about 5% coming back your way. I also really like Currys as well. Eat several of them a week, so it'd be good to try and get some money back from there.
Yeah, yeah. The TVs are incredibly tasty, as are toasters and KitchenAid machines, yeah.
I'm annoyed at how much silence you left after that joke as well. It's not getting edited out. Oh well, I'll crop in my own laughter at my own jokes then.
What Fine. Have you consumed this week, Steve?
Well, none of those things. I am looking forward to the Monzo thing though. Chip, I'm not with, and CarWow, I have seen advertised several times but haven't used them. When I don't know, sort of the fact they're advertising kind of indicates to me that they're in a position to be at least doing that. I, like you, used my good consumption thing earlier in the week for the show we've recorded to come out in probably a month or two's time. So not that, but I did have a listen this morning to the Baron Streetwise podcast as I was off to go and get the shopping, and I had plenty of time to do it because the people in Sainsbury's left me in the car park for long enough to let me listen to the whole show. It's always interesting on there. Their kind of tagline for this week is something like three European blue chips under six times earnings or something, which is eye-catching title. I would have listened to it anyway because I generally do listen to that show. Sometimes, like last week, it doesn't have that much on it for me because it's about things like US pension schemes and that sort of stuff, which don't really apply to me in the same sort of direct way. But this week was very interesting. They actually, the bit they didn't kind of include in their headline was some quite interesting stuff on Hasbro, which is worth looking at. If anyone owns Games Workshop and is impressed by their kind of IP and their protection they have around that, they might think Hasbro's kind of interesting here. Steve, you will remember that a while back they had a kind of Wizards of the Coast big deep dive-ish sort of thing with Jackson Cantrell doing some like on-the-ground reporting from a Wizards of the Coast convention. That's because the price of everything was going up, including trading cards, and Hasbro were trying to work out how and whether they could cash in on this kind of trend while the going was good. Anyway, they have pretty strong IP as well. They have a mighty dividend yield that appears to be closing in on around 6% at the moment. They do have some competition from Mattel, which they sort of back and forth with a little bit, but it looks to me like quite an interesting stock, one I might take a bit more of a look at, although I'm not sure there's that much more to tell you for a future episode. In case you're wondering, the three stocks from Europe, and when we say Europe, I always think of as kind of continental Europe. I never include the UK as Europe in my head when I think about, because I think of UK, Europe and America as kind of markets. But the three are, I think one's called CNH, which is a tractor company and based in Italy or something like that. And they trade at six times earnings. And the guy who was doing it said he wasn't really sure why, which I get what he meant. He meant that there is, as far as he can tell, no good reason why this stock should be at six times earnings. And that does happen in the markets. Things get mispriced quite a bit. But the way he said it sort of made it sound like, you should probably go and look at it a bit more then and try and figure it out, rather than just saying, I don't know why it's at six times earnings. What the hell we got you on this show for? The other two, though, were Bayer, the kind of ag and pharma outfit, and Lloyds from the UK. They're bullish on Lloyds. And we've said before we kind of like it when people... we like listening to people who disagree with us on stuff, and we also get a kind of nice a nice shot of something when we find people agree with us. I like it when people agree with me when I didn't necessarily think they were going to. I mean, his take on Lloyds is basically that it's in a sector that's hard work, but is clearly the best operator in there. And I think I broadly agree with that, actually. If I think about kind of UK banks, I think Lloyds have done reasonably well to avoid generating extra problems for themselves compared to everybody else. So the Streetwise podcast is one we have talked about before, recommended before, generally think pretty highly of, both from an informational perspective and from an entertainment perspective. Actually, there's some that we talk up for one reason or another. This one, I think, scores pretty well on both of those things. That's what I've been consuming this week, Steve. I guess you probably haven't had much of a chance to listen yet. It only came out sort of yesterday or this morning, and you haven't had the luxury of sitting in a car park for 25 minutes while someone tries to figure out where your groceries are in this grocery store.
No, I haven't, but that does sound really, really interesting. So that'll definitely be one that I was looking at. I actually put off last week's Streetwise as well because it seemed like it was a bit US specific. Yeah, it was about health plans, and I've sort of muddled through it a couple of days ago, and I think I got about halfway through it before I realized my initial suspicion was correct. So there is the danger of that, I suppose, with the Streetwise podcast. But the vast majority of the time, it is, as you say, very, very entertaining and quite informational. Jack Jahawa's voice on that that health plan one is absolutely ruined. It sounds like he's been sort of drunk for 3 weeks and also has COVID, so he's quite hard to get through. And he says to Meta, I'd like a nice quiet day today where I don't have to do much talking, and it basically talks for 20 minutes straight.
Yeah, that theme kind of carries on this week. I won't spoil it for you too much, but there are also some guest voicing appearances from Mark Zuckerberg and Kermit the Frog. See if you can tell which one is which is kind of part of their theme. But nonetheless, that is enough on things we've consumed for the moment. Let's talk about things where, well, let's watch Steve do some victory laps while he talks about Adyen's Investor Day. It's not like you mentioned this like a week ago or something when we talked about PayPal, was it?
So, yeah, I mean, last week we said that going through PayPal's report just made me like Adyen more. And that was sort of proven out this week. So, Adyen basically called an ad hoc Q3 Investor Day, which doesn't happen. So, in Adyen's territory, they only do half reporting. So, basically, we only had a half report just a few weeks ago. So, for them to call a sort of third quarter business update was kind of like them saying, "You weren't listening." Essentially, and that that tended to be the case. I think we were trying to explain it when the earnings came in that yes, it was disappointing that earnings were down. Process volume was down already because Adyen said we'd be looking at sort of 25% plus growth for the foreseeable future, and then the first week it came in, they were sort of down to like 20% growth, and obviously that's. You know, the first time after you make a long-term prediction like that, you sure as damn it want to hit, you know, at least 25%, and they didn't. So I could understand why Adyen went down, but the 40 sort of 50% it went down and then continued to go down afterwards, I felt was oversold, and I hope I said that on a number of occasions. So this is Adyen's third quarter 23 business update. They didn't release very many numbers, but here are the ones that they released. So process volume came in at 243 billion. That's up 21%. Net revenue was 414 million euros. That's plus 22%, and that's 26% FX neutral. Digital volumes was up 21%. Unified commerce was up 25%. Platforms total volume, this is excluding eBay, was up 15%. If you include eBay, it was up 120%. So massive, massive growth in terms of the sort of volume of things that are going through Adyen's platform there. They reiterated the long-term goals. So they said net revenue growth from the low to high 20s, compound average growth rate through 2026. They said that they'll improve their EBITDA margin to 50% in 2026. Now, remember, a lot of places are misquoting this stat because they're using the wrong revenue term because they basically take the full platform volume they take the full revenue and forget that Adyen has to pay out a lot of fees to other providers, so you should really use net revenue when you're thinking about this. Improve the EBITDA margin back to 50%. It has been as high as 65%, and they also said that their long-term target is for it to head back to 65% margins now that they've finished this sort of capex cycle that they've just gone through, this hiring cycle. They're now going to refocus on operating leverage to get back to 65%. And the third goal was to maintain CapEx at 5% of net revenue, which again is, you know, the sort of things people want to hear at the moment in terms of a business sort of looking after its shareholders. So I went through the call. They basically, the whole idea of this call was to explain to the market what they missed in the last half. And I think they did a really good job of it. So here's just the quotes that I've pulled out of it. And then I'll pass over to you, Steve, to tell me what you think. But they said, Adyen isn't a payment processor. They're a financial technology platform, and they have banking licenses across the world. They said that North America isn't just a great growth opportunity. North America is a great growth opportunity for them. They actually only have low single-digit market share at the moment. Therefore, they're hiring faster in the U.S., to obviously accelerate that market share growth. And they also now have a full banking license in America as well. The president of EMEA is Alexa von Bismarck, who sounds like she would be the president of EMEA. She said that we are the only financial technology provider that can run all channels. That's online, in-store, mobile, and an app on a single end-to-end technology that spans across multiple geographies. And every part of it is fully built in-house. No one else can do that. And then they gave some examples, Steve, of their AI machine learning, which was an interesting little tidbit there. It was quite an impressive showcase of what Adyen's AI can do. And the example that I've pulled out was quite an interesting one. Basically, they've taken Body Shop from what they called an unnamed competitor. And just through applying this AI anti-fraud sort of technology they've got, they've managed to get 8% higher authorizations than the previous payment provider. So forget about the fees there, Steve. It doesn't really matter what the fees are. If you're paying 0.2 to say PayPal and 0.3 to Adyen, if you can swap to Adyen and get 8% higher authorizations just by clicking your fingers, Steve, it doesn't matter what the fees are. And that's what Adyen have always kind of tried to explain to people, that, you know, no fees worth lower authorizations. And can you imagine just swapping to a payment provider overnight and getting 8% more sales? Who the hell, as a large scale operation like you would assume the Body Shop are, that's millions more hitting their coffers just from swapping a payment provider. So yeah, it was a really quite impressive update, and justly so, the stock rose about 40%. Fortunately for me, I'm still down about 12% on this, because it fell from sort of 1700s where I'd been averaging up to about 600, where I averaged down quite heavily. I added about 40% or 33, maybe 40% to my position. I brought it down to about 1100. I think the stock's just under 1000 now, so I've still got a little bit to go before I go green on this one. But it made a huge difference to my portfolio midweek, Steve, and I think sort of justly so. What do you think?
Yeah, I can see that you'd be it's just below 1000 at the moment, and it's back roughly where it was in the sort of 2020 period. It's been quite the fall, and it's a reminder that I guess that if you lose a big number and then you gain the same big number in percent terms, that doesn't put you back where you started again. That said, I think this is a sort of familiar-ish story. Well, there's two parts to it. There's the, I don't want to sound all Paul here, because why would I ever do that? But there's the kind of qualitative stuff and the kind of quantitative stuff. Qualitatively, okay, sounds convincing. Sounds pretty good. They can do everything in-house, better conversions from AI. You mentioned AI, that's why stock's going up, right? Quantitatively, though, I'm much, much, much more impressed. It looks to me like revenues are still growing fast at this company. It's worth noting that they got dinged a bit, or dinged more than a little bit, to be honest, for the idea that revenues might be slowing down a bit. But if you start thinking that a combination of revenues are going to stay reasonably growthy and margins are going to start expanding, that's the story we've been seeing throughout this kind of earnings season, I think. And it's the story from we've seen from big tech. So mostly places like Meta and Alphabet, and to an extent Amazon, have been firing everybody, and that's made their earnings per share go through the roof, because they're still growing pretty well and their margins are getting wider at the same time. That's been quite a powerful kind of combination. So Adyen, as I'm looking at the moment, the number I see from Google, which isn't always entirely accurate, says PE of around 50. Start pushing that higher with revenues and start widening margins at the same time. You said EBITDA margins going from 50 to 65 or so over the midterm. But now that they've stopped taking on extra costs of hiring and so on, big tech's been doing it the other way around by kicking people out and Adyen hoovering them up. That could start to look pretty good pretty quickly when you get that kind of double boost from these sorts of things, I think.
Yeah, it's operating leverage, isn't it? That's exactly what operating leverage is. So, mm-hmm. Adyen have highlighted an opportunity, which is basically attacking America. They've realized that the incumbents are weak, and they're going to. And I mean, you could hear that in the PayPal CEO's when he was talking quite openly and honestly about PayPal. He explained that they were essentially a sticking plaster sort of built business, and that they needed to sort of double down and unify the code. And Adyen already has it. And can you imagine, you know, if you're a PayPal customer or a Braintree customer, and Adyen just walks in and says, we can offer you all of this for a very similar price, and, you know, you're going to get 8% higher authorizations. That's you're going to move off pretty quickly, aren't you, to be honest with you. So I think this could be the beginning of a really interesting growth story if Adyen can get this across the line. So interesting that they're doing a lot of hiring in America, growing out that team, growing out a big sales team. They're going to need it. America is a very sort of sales team led environment. So I think it's definitely the right move. And if this pays off, Steve, I think it's one of those stocks that everybody thinks is really, really expensive. Sort of like Mercado Libre. Everybody looks at it and thinks this is very, very expensive. And then after 5 or 6 years of growing at sort of 25 to 30%, everybody looks at it and says, oh, that price, I thought it was really expensive. I mean, if I'd have bought it at that, I'd be looking at like a 10 PE or a 15 PE today. So yeah, it's going to trade at a premium because it's a premium business, and everybody likes improving margins and fast growing revenue, Steve. I think that's sort of what we're looking for in every business.
Yes, and there's an interesting sort of psychological element to this for you personally, I guess. You mentioned you're still sort of 17% behind. I mean, that, to my mind, it's not a good thing. You don't want to be behind on these things, but it does mean that as compared to someone who bought it, I don't know, a week ago and is now sort of 20% up or so, if you bought this 20 a week ago and got part of your portfolio into it, you might be struggling to think, even if you zoom out and look at the 5-year chart and see that you're not far from where you were, you're up a little bit, but you're back at sort of 2020 levels and you've just come down a much bigger thing than you've just gone back up. You can still see the room to run there, but you start thinking to yourself, yeah, but Oh man, it's up 20% already. How do I keep buying this thing? Much easier when you're behind psychologically there. And that's not a reason to go and buy things when they're higher, so you can go and buy them again and feel good when they're lower. But it makes it easier for you to start getting more money into this thing, I think, psychologically. If you're still 19 behind and the business is looking really good and the market is starting to respond and so on, chance for you to pull that in even more here and get your average somewhere to somewhere really quite nice at the moment, because if you try and look at this in a vacuum, the price doesn't look too bad. When you start looking at the chart, either in the very recent past, it looks now high, or in the slightly, let's say year to date past or so, it now looks quite low. So in a vacuum, it looks kind of quite nice. And there's a chance here for you to get in with a nice averaging down move, I think.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there. I'm just looking now, 16.65% down. So my average is 1126 for total
parity.
That's a nice
number to be kind of pulling down that.
Yeah. I've just the problem of having cash at the moment. I've got enough to buy one share about in cash at the moment, but you know, it's an expensive share to buy. So, you know, that's an option. The only problem I've got at the moment is I've got quite a few stocks that are just kind of in that kind of range that I think the market's mispricing. So you always think like, Adyen, and then you're looking at Alexandria and thinking this is stupid. Do you know what I mean? And even Four Corners I've bought a lot of recently. So I mean, over the last few weeks, a lot of my stuff has trended from sort of marginally red to quite strongly green. So the options are reducing by the day. But you know me, Steve, I don't really like to hold cash, and I don't like to sit on my hands very much. So buying Adyen is definitely something that will happen, I think, between sort of now and April.
In general, are you finding it's easier or harder to hold cash at the moment than it used to be? So, wind back when we started doing this show, for instance, you got nothing for your cash pretty much from basically anywhere. And everyone sort of knew that. And as a result, share prices were much higher than they are at the moment. So, there was a kind of, I don't really know what to do with this. I don't want to leave it in cash, but I'm not mad keen on buying things at these prices at the moment. They look quite inflated. Or at least you'll have to sit around and wait for the return while the business grows into it. Compare that to today, where Share prices are much lower in general. Certainly in some of the stuff that we're looking at, we're thinking the thought you just expressed, which is, I've got loads of places I could put this. Adyen looks good, but Adyen looks like one good one amongst quite a lot of good ones, to be honest. That said, you also have something of an incentive to, you hang on to your cash for a week, you'll get a few more pence on it, and not just from trading 212. Are you finding it easier or harder to buy at the moment?
It's strange, isn't it? Because it's like stocks like LVMH, where you think to yourself, like, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to make this business work in my head. And so then you think, well, I'll go for the next best one, which was Kering, which was a lot better priced. But now they've both fallen down about the same amount. You sort of look at Kering and think, well, maybe I should switch that into LVMH. And maybe that's a really, really sensible move to just up the quality from one to the other. But in terms of holding cash, yeah, I am. I guess I've never been very good at it. It's never been something I'm good at. But when you get in sort of 5% in something like CSH2 or something like that, and it is a decent place to just sort of park your cash for a little bit of time. But when you know that you're going to get 5% from a money market fund, it's very different to when you're sitting there and you're doing all the maths and you're working it out and you're thinking at something like Alexandria and you think, well, this is, from here, this seems to me like a nailed on 10% return. I'm not greedy. I'm not after anything more than that. So when I put 10% into my sort of valuation spreadsheets and it comes out quite comfortably, you know, above the share price that it is today, and you think to yourself, well, that to me then is a no-brainer. And that's happened with a lot of my stocks, is that I've built them up into positions that are way outsized what they should be. So I in my pie on trading 212, it'll say that Amazon needs to be, I think, 8%. I'll just double check that while we're on air. So and I know that it's so far above 8% because when it went down last year, I bought so much of it. So Amazon's meant to be 9%. It's currently 12.5%. So it's a third bigger than it should be. And I've got that happening in a lot of places. So, I mean, Adyen's meant to be 4%. It's 5.5%. Four Corners is meant to be 4%. It's 5%. And that is just simply because I just think that there's just quite a lot of good prices out there. And I keep seeing these articles coming out, and it's saying that the America is grossly overpriced. And you think to yourself, well, it might be if you include the 7 at the top. But if you are buying the 7 at the top, America is not that expensive. Europe is not that expensive. And Britain is really cheap, from at least from a historic perspective. So I think there's plenty of buying out there, Steve. And we and you have never struggled to find something to buy. We're always finding stuff to buy. But I think especially so at the moment.
If anyone's interested in seeing how cheap Britain is, or specifically the FTSE 100 as a UK index compared to stuff like America, one of the things that I consumed but didn't list as my consumption thing for this week, I was actually going to try and save it, but I'll say it now. Tom's Personal Finance, who frequently appears in our kind of comment section on YouTube, has a video on buying UK stocks, and he covers a few things like not quite the equity risk premium in the same way as you might think about that, but the relationship between UK stocks and US shares and why one tends to trade lower than the other and whether there's better value there and is that offset by growth and those kind of things. So check out that video. I might chuck it in the consumption section if I can find it for this, even though that's not my consumption piece. But yeah, positive stuff on Adyen, and enjoying your victory lap then, Steve.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess how can you not? Do you know what I mean? When something goes up 30-odd% and it's a massive company like Adyen, how can you not enjoy it?
Yeah, I mean, you should, right? People tell us when we're wrong about stuff, and that happens often, and we try and point them out as well ourselves some of the time. So worth enjoying it when you're right about these things, right? That's only being even-handed about it.
Especially in the last sort of couple of years when it was, you know, it was quite easy to be wrong. Well, last year, I think I was wrong about absolutely everything, so it is nice to be right from time to time.
Yeah, I'll let you know when I learn what that feels like. Although I think I'm going to be okay with the house price thing this year. Okay, should we talk about something different? Let's talk about Berkshire Hathaway then. So Berkshire Hathaway announced their earnings. They like reporting them on the weekend because they're fun like that. And so there wasn't really a market reaction at the immediate time. But their Q3 earnings report looks like this. Revenues were $93 billion, up from $77 billion in the Q3 of the year before. Earnings per share were down. So they lost a total of $12.7 billion in net income, and that equated to a loss of $5.88 per share. But As Buffett has been saying well before the start of this earnings thing, the movements in their stock portfolio, which is quite big, can cause things to go a bit misleading. Operating income wise, which is the number they think you should look at, was 10.8 billion rather than 7.7 billion. I'll break that down in a moment, but just sticking with the pre-tax, post-tax thing. Someone asked the question a little while ago, how could a company be profitable pre-tax and not post-tax? Here is one way, strictly, I guess. I mean, operating income, you then take out things like movements in share prices. So anything that, if the equity portfolio is worth less by market value than it was start of the quarter, you then have to kind of write that down. And then when it goes up again, you write it back up again. And then when it goes down, you write it back down again. And that makes the earnings go all wobbly, even though I know it's not a cash-based accounting system, but no cash is going anywhere, or at least it doesn't imply any cash is going anywhere on this. The company was actually a net seller of stocks over the last 3 months. It's known, I think, already. 13F's come out later this week, but or their 13F will come out later this week. Some are already out. Charlie Munger did the Daily Journal's one. He probably did that about 5 years ago, to be honest. Nothing to see there again. But even with 13F's out, not yet, it's known that there's been a couple of things that the company's been buying. One is Occidental Petroleum, because they own so much of that company that they have to now report it separately. And the other is they've been spending about $1 billion and change on some buybacks. Buybacks at these levels are interesting to me. I don't have this as a particularly undervalued stock relative to other things at the moment. I have it as a particularly good company relative to other things at the moment, but I don't think this is the most obvious bargain. It's not where I'm thinking I'm going to go and fling a load of money at this right now. Sort of regret not doing that a bit earlier. But so operating income was slightly higher. The net income number is lower, but mostly due to sort of shifts in a share portfolio, which kind of odd since it's led by Apple, and Apple's done okay, but it's had a bumpy-ish quarter. Breaking out the operating income a little bit, there's a kind of theme running through this. So insurance underwriting was 2.4 billion, which was up from a loss of one last year. The investment income that comes from those insurance operations was up to 2.4 billion from 1.4. Railroads were down to 1.2 from 1.4. Utilities and energy were down from 1.6 to 5. Pilot travel centers, which is new, came in at 0.1. Other controlled businesses were 3.3 billion, up from 3.2. Non-controlled businesses were 226 million, up from 346 million. And other, which is basically FX and stuff, was a bit lower. So the broad theme here is insurance doing well, and the kind of operating-y bits of things are generally going the other way. I didn't view this as terribly good news, because it was kind of known that there was going to be some, or at least I say it was kind of known. I didn't hear many people talking about it, but if you listened at the annual meeting last year, you would have known that insurance investment income was going to go up, because they got a load of great deals on bonds as a result of a kind of blip in the bond market. So what was generating them not much was going to generate them a lot. Higher interest rates do that with income investing things. Insurance generally going well, everything else a bit more wobbly, and I wonder whether that speaks to the US sort of more broadly here. But Steve, thoughts on Berkshire or anything like that?
It was definitely a sort of under the hood, things are not quite as good as they would seem if you just sort of read the earnings figures and said, you know, that's great. There was a few little bits and pieces in there that were just a little bit sort of wobbly. But it's hard to sort of criticize anything that Berkshire are doing at the moment. I mean, they've got cash piles here that are bigger than most companies' market caps. So, you know,
yeah, 157 billion is the current cash pile, of which it's a little unclear as to how much needs to go aside for insurance loss reserves and so on, because you can't run an insurance business and not have cash. But just over 100 was the Morningstar estimate of how much they have available to go and deploy against something. You could buy something for 100 billion. Maybe they'll like let it, I don't know, go up 6 times and buy Tesla.
Yeah, I spotted at the weekend that the criticism of Berkshire has started to rear its head again, in that he's sitting on cash and he's not spending it. A poor fella called Oliver MMMT Finance CPA. He said that Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway has just hit a record $157.2 billion in cash. Does this believe he means there's no deals in the market, or does it mean he sees a recession looming and is waiting to deploy cash? Either way, Berkshire is going to feel pressure to start investing the cash pile. And you just think to yourself, like, do you guys never learn? Do you know what I mean? Like, over the last sort of 40 years, people have been like making absolutely ridiculous statements like this, like Buffett feels pressure to do absolutely anything. And he was getting panned in the comment section, as you would imagine. People were saying, just leave Buffett to, there's no need to believe Buffett. Buffett is the best steward of capital in the world. And this guy responded and said that you believe Buffett is the best steward with capital. And you think to yourself, what do you mean believe? I mean, you don't need to believe things. These are, you know, these are facts. He's been one of the, over the longest period of time, he's been one of the best investors in the world. He's I had to step in and tell him that, you know, despite regular detraction from idiots, he is the all-time best steward of capital that, you know, that I think we've got alive at the moment still investing. So I think you're more than happy to just sit there and let him figure it out for himself. And you watch, when things need to be bought, Buffett will buy them. When there are opportunities out there, Buffett will take those opportunities. But while there are not screaming buyers out there, Buffett's happy to sit where he is. I mean, he sat there with 51% of Apple at the top of his portfolio at the moment. And I think there are plenty of things out there. When I was looking at Buffett paying a premium, which made me laugh, people were talking about, you know, when there's a premium to be paid, Buffett will pay a premium. A premium for Buffett, when you look back at his things, is about a 10 PE, Steve. That's what he considers a premium. I think one of them was a 12, and I think that's about as high as I've seen him go. We're not that low yet. But if we do go to that kind of levels, watch Buffett fire the elephant gun and watch him pick up some incredible companies at cheap prices.
Yeah, we're not that low yet. And I think when the time comes that we start, or the areas where we are getting that low, as you mentioned, outside the top end of big tech, it's stuff that's too small for Berkshire as part of the issue. So to Oliver's point, I'm happy enough with the idea there might well be some bargains somewhere that Buffett hasn't seen because they're just not on his radar. I looked at it, and I when I had a quick look for an article I was writing yesterday, I think I worked out that either 89 or 90 of the FTSE 100 are just too small to be meaningful Berkshire things. So some quick back of the envelope maths indicated to me that you need about six to be able to get about $6 billion into a company in dollars for it to make up even 2% of Berkshire's portfolio. So anything, assuming you don't want to buy more than 10% of a company because that triggers additional reporting requirements, then you need about a 60 billion, 49 in UK terms, billion market cap. Nothing in the FTSE 250 is anywhere near that. And most of the FTSE 100 isn't either. So there's only about nine things you can look at. And it's not incredible to me to think those nine things are not screaming bargains at the moment. Two of them are oil companies. Another one is Unilever. Another one is British Tobacco, I think. And I'm happy enough with the idea that no, none of those are screaming buys from the UK. US wise, there's more available, but I tend to think that going back to something I was watching before, I was listening to Ashworth the Motor and suggesting the market still seems to be in denial a little bit about higher for longer interest rates. Things are pricing as though they believe there's a cut coming sooner rather than later. And it looks to me like Buffett might feel the same way. I don't particularly go in for this sort of mind reading thing. Despite kind of, some under the hood sort of issues. Okay, the insurance stuff has gone up. Operating income's gone higher. The thing is trading at around 17 times operating earnings, which doesn't look like a huge discount to me at the moment if you sort of roughly take the operating income, multiply it by four, and then compare it to the market cap. So I don't think it's terribly cheap. That's why I was interested in the buybacks thing, to be honest. I mean, they talk about only really buying back stock when it's trading at a significant discount. $157 billion in cash. They have a $761 billion market cap. They could take a big lump out of that with that, and then all of a sudden the share price would start going higher. It's up 13% year-to-date, even after a little... If you zoom it out, you can't really see it on the month chart. You can't tell which one is the movement following the earnings thing and which ones are just general general ups and downs, to be honest. Remains, I think, my largest single stock investment. So things have gone sort of okay this year, mostly in virtue of just having that knocking around. There'll be times when it doesn't. Paying attention to the more I look at this, the more I think with the kind of inactivity going on at the company and their need to not constantly say, here is what we're doing, here is how we're trying to grow this thing, here is our plan for kind of optimizing this, that, or the other, the more I think there'll be good years and bad years. This may be one or the other, to be honest. We'll see what happens going forwards.
The only thing I think is a shame is if you think higher for longer, or even this level for longer on interest rates, it's a real shame, I think, that Buffett isn't into his real estate, because with that 150-odd billion, he could pick up some pretty good businesses, you know, clear the debt piles, which is the problem at a lot of these REITs, and have some really, really interesting businesses. But it's just something he's never – I mean, I was thinking the other day, somebody was saying about they were quoting Buffett when they were buying Realty Income. And I was thinking, I can't even remember times when I saw REITs as serious positions in Berkshire's portfolio for more than a quarter. It's something he's never owned, and which is a shame, really. I guess he is staying within his circle of competence, absolutely, there, because he's never been a property purchaser. He still lives in his like original home. And I think they've only ever had one HQ, Berkshire, as well, in the centre of Omaha. So he's definitely not somebody who's even really dabbled his toe in real estate purchases. So, but it is a shame. I do feel like that would be the move at the moment for me.
Quoting Buffett when buying Realty Income is tricky, because the only things I've heard Buffett say about REITs are they're not negative, but they do very much put them outside of his area that he might look at. So when it usually comes up in the times I've heard it talked about, when someone's been asking whether Berkshire might pay a dividend, a bit like a REIT does. And he's sort of said, not quite in these terms, but if you want dividends, go and buy a REIT or an MLP. Basically, that's not really what we do at Berkshire. What we do is we try and get hold of as much cash as we can and then go and invest that in places that it will grow. Dividending it out is pretty much the opposite of investing it in ways that it will grow. And we may be wrong about that, and we might not find places that we can put it. And we can be, you know, doubtful about what the strength or and so on of these opportunities is, and we can absolutely misjudge them. But in terms of what we're trying to do, we are trying to go and invest it in places, usually in businesses, sometimes in stocks and occasionally in bonds, such that we will make more money like this, and that's what will make the company worth more. Not sending it out like you basically have to if you're a REIT. He said the kind of person who owns typically REITs is not going to be the kind of investor that owns Berkshire Hathaway. I say this as both a Realty Income shareholder and a Berkshire Hathaway shareholder. I view these as quite different investments, though, and that's fine.
Fair enough. Do you want me to do Disney?
Yes, let's talk about the mouse.
Okay. So this was this actually wasn't the greatest report that I think I've seen, and sort of long-running Disney theme here. But the market liked it, Steve. So I saw a top-line miss. I saw the bottom line was a good hit, a good beat. Market sent this one up 6%. So I've had a little dig around and just tried to sort of see what the market was seeing. In terms of headline numbers, EPS was 82 cents adjusted. The market was expecting 70 cents. Revenues, they were expecting 21.33 billion, and Disney was 21.24 billion. So only a very slight miss. And that's about 5% growth on the quarter. That's about 7% on the year. So I went searching for the miss. The miss I found was caused by a couple of segments, really. Entertainment revenue came in at 9.52 billion, and they were expecting 9.77 billion. Experiences revenue came in at 8.16 billion, and the market was expecting 8.2 billion. So that's kind of where the misses were. So entertainment and experiences slightly weaker, but not massively weaker. There's plenty of highlights in the quarter, Steve. Disney Plus has resumed growth again. This is in the core and not in the sort of crappy Hotstar India version where they're not actually paying for it. The subscribers grew about 7 million and the market was only expecting 2.68 million. So Disney sort of following Netflix in that regard in terms of subscribers, which is something they've not done recently. They tended to follow each other over the last sort of 18, well, take 6 months off, then the 18 months before that. they were following each other, but the last two quarters, definitely not. They sort of reiterated that they're going to be at streaming profitability by this time next year. So just a year away from Disney Plus actually sort of being positive to the bottom line. ESPN's operating income grew year on year, which is interesting for a cable TV channel. You would expect that to be in sort of terminal decline now. Experiences operating income was up 30% year on year. So that's very healthy indeed. They had an efficiency target about when Bob Iger took back over, and he said he thought that they could make about $5.5 billion in efficiency savings over the year. They've actually upped that now, Steve, because they're achieving efficiency quite quickly. They're now going to achieve $7.5 billion, so it's almost a 50% increase in efficiency. Although I did sort of think that hinted towards something going. I think something is going to get sold, because that is quite a large leap in efficiency. You can't often get that just by, you know, sacking a few people and sort of reorganizing a few departments. So we'll be interested with that. Disney now expects next year's free cash flow to be in line with pre-pandemic highs. It's actually guiding to make about $8 billion in free cash flow next year. That's quite a bit. So Bob was on CNBC, and he said, our results reflect the significant progress we've made over the past year. While we still have work to do, these efforts have allowed us to move beyond this period of fixing and begin building our business again, in the true storyteller that he is. He also hyped up a few films coming out in the next year. He hyped up The Marvels, which I think is doing quite poorly at the moment, and Wish. And he also said that Deadpool 3, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, Inside Out 2, and Mufasa are all sort of scheduled for next year. He didn't mention the new Captain America film, which is the one that I think the Marvel sort of fanboys are really sort of clamoring for. So that sounds to me like that's been pushed out for 2024, because it was mentioned in 2024, I think 6 months ago. But no, that sounds to me like that's coming in 2025. There's obviously the case that next year is an election year around the world. I think it was pointed out on The Rest Is Politics that I think it said 80% of the developed world are going through are having elections next year, and that includes obviously the UK, the US, and it's the European elections as well. So that's going to give Disney's linear networks a little push, because obviously they own things like ABC, which will get some kind of political sort of political messaging on there. But it's a decent report, Steve, this anyway. There was a lot of interesting bits in there. You could see the sort of green shoots of recovery. I think right now looks a lot brighter for Disney than it has done when Bob took charge. And he deserves credit for that, because I think we were both a little bit sceptical about the problems he came in to fix. We thought he was maybe the problems were sort of caused by himself. But whoever caused the problems, Bob's doing a decent job at the moment of fixing them. What do you think?
It looks to me like Disney has gone back to thinking about being bottom line, and in some sense very bottom line in terms of kind of free cash flow focused and repairing stuff there. If you think about the kind of Chapek era, it was characterized, I think, and this is partly not a Disney specific feature, by losses in its direct to consumer stuff and attempting to grow and build its streaming division, along with kind of price hikes at parks and, you know, sort of gouging to cover it a little bit. And it seems like Bob Iger's put them back on a kind of profitable growth strategy. And that, I think the way people will look back on that is in terms of, okay, this is a fix to the bottom line. It is also, I think, reflective of broader shifts elsewhere in kind of the macro economy. And it wasn't obviously the case that going hell for leather with subscriber growth was the wrong thing to be doing. You're right there. It sounds like something's got to go efficiency-wise. I'm not sure that 7.5 billion, if that is what you can get by sacking people, and you should sack another 10 of them or so, because you're clearly overpaying these people massively. 8 billion in free cash flow puts the stock now at about 20 times next year's free cash flow, which is not crazy for something that very clearly has very strong brand intangible assets and will therefore have a decent kind of look through onto future earnings and stuff. It will go up and down a little bit, and there's always noise around things like actors and what have you. But good to see subscriber growth still coming through for Disney. I sort of view that positively. It seems like a lot of people do view it positively. And I wonder whether the reason why is we've talked about this theme a little bit with various different companies. The most obvious candidates being Netflix from a while ago and Meta from slightly more recently than that of, well, sometimes they reach levels where they are basically priced to fail at everything. So Meta had that when it was busy knocking holes in its own cash flows using the metaverse. That seemed to be reaching a point at 11 times earnings where it just was priced to fail at the whole damn lot. And when Netflix's subscriber growth started going into reverse just very briefly, all of a sudden people were thinking this must be game over for Netflix. It's never going to make any money ever again. And then you only needed a couple of things to go right. In fairness, at both at Meta and Netflix, more than a couple of things went right since then. They've done genuinely quite impressive things. But their market caps and share prices were implying a kind of max level pessimism here. And I wonder whether Disney at around 80 or so, which is where I saw it not terribly long ago, was implying something close to that. And if you can see, you can even see slightly your way through. You don't really need a big complicated story of here's all the things they're going to do and here's why they're all going to work and here's how much they're all going to make here. It only takes a little bit at that level to start thinking, well, actually things could look up quite quickly from here.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I think the market sort of always sort of overthinks how long a turnaround is going to take. If a company's going to turn around, it tends to happen fairly quickly, and I think that's kind of what we're seeing with Disney here. Interesting stat though, Steve. So Berkshire has $157 billion in cash. Disney's currently $156 billion. So why don't Berkshire go out and buy Disney? I can give you a second option if you want, Steve, because for the same amount of money, you could also buy Robinhood, Snapchat, Coinbase, Spotify, DoorDash, and Palantir. Huh. Which would you rather have if you was Warren Buffett?
That's interesting to me. So my initial answer that came to mind with your why doesn't Berkshire buy Disney thing is because Charlie Munger doesn't like Hollywood types. However, what Charlie Munger likes less than Hollywood types is pretty much all of those things you just described. Coinbase, Robinhood, whatever the hell the rest of it was, DoorDash, something else. You say Palantir in there? Yeah, that's probably another
Coinbase,
candidate.
Snapchat, Robinhood, Spotify, DoorDash, and Palantir.
Yeah, that lot. I don't think he's got much use for any of those things, apart from maybe Spotify, to be honest. I think I could imagine Charlie Munger not hating that, but I think the reason for going in for that is mainly to do with the idea that these are not Berkshire type businesses. These are not businesses they understand very well.
You don't think Charlie Munger gets his gravy dinners delivered by DoorDash?
I doubt very much he gets his gravy dinners delivered by DoorDash, although that does strike me as possible. I think he buys them in Costco, if I'm honest with you, but
yeah, I agree.
If they ran like a, I mean, Deliveroo now will get stuff from a supermarket for you. Maybe DoorDash could do something like that, and there would be a, I mean, this is basically just Meals on Wheels again, isn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. I think, you know, there's use for Charlie of everything there. It's like Snapchat. I think I could see Charlie Munger using Snapchat now.
Maybe.
Do you read,
less
Steve?
So on that one. Okay, fine. Let's talk about one last thing then that I've been holding on to for a little bit here. I found another REIT to talk about. REITs are things that I think at the moment tend to be fairly lowly priced. This one has a dividend that's around 7% and a bit. So it's caught my eye for I think, the right reasons here. It has a really cool, sexy name. It's called Supermarket Income REIT. Based in the UK, and UK properties are kind of interesting at the moment. This thing owns 55 properties, and yes, they are all indeed supermarkets. They are let to tenants like Aldi, like Sainsbury's, like Tesco, like Morrison's, like Waitrose, like all the kind of UK supermarkets you can imagine, except as far as I can tell, Lidl. We don't have any tenant-based Lidl stuff for the moment. Let's get to the kind of big reason that I'm bullish on this stock then. One of their stores is in a place called Hessel, which I gather to be somewhere near Hull. So I think there's going to be a kind of nearby-ish effect rubbing off on this of being next to the kind of financial capital of the East Riding of Yorkshire.
That's where I'm going tonight, Hessel, for my meal.
Oh, there we go. So all kinds of interesting things have staken blown off night Hessel, and if you get time to pop into what I assume must be I'm not sure what it is, actually. It might be an Aldi nearby. Go check that out as well. Stock is down 21% year to date. Had a little rally recently with news on interest rates helping, because that's the main thing that's been weighing on them. But it has a market cap now of just under $1 billion or so for its 55 properties. Since we always talk about this stuff with REITs, it becomes easier the smaller they are, actually, or the numbers become more granular the smaller they are. But yes, they are 100% let in their 55 properties. And they are also, they've collected all the rent they're supposed to be collecting as well. That is, you're never going to get a number like 99.7% when you only have 55 of these things. If you lose one of them, you lose a decent sort of chunk of it. But Tesco and Sainsbury's between them make up about 75% of the rent roll. So there's a little bit of a concentration risk, I think, there. I think, though, I would tend to view this as them being let to people who are unlikely to default. We'll come back to Sainsbury's in a second because they're an interesting bunch. They have a portfolio that's valued at around $1.373 billion. Knock off some debt gets you to a net asset value of around $1.2 billion. As I mentioned, the market cap is currently just under $1 billion, so we're trading at a discount to NAV. Normally, I don't care about things trading at discounts to NAV or discounts to book, particularly because unless you're about to sell all those things and realize the difference, it doesn't really matter. We might just keep trading there forever. I'm far more interested in the cash flows that are coming through and in and out of that business. But this time things are a little bit different. In the case of Supermarket Income REIT, it is selling off some of its buildings, and there's a reason for this. It sold off some of its stuff to Sainsbury's recently, and it used that to boost the dividend. The reason it's been selling them off is, as far as I can tell, supermarkets, if you're a Tesco and a Sainsbury's in particular, you are realizing something quite quickly, which is that Aldi and Lidl have lower prices than you, and that people will go where the nearest prices are. And despite club cards and Nectar points and various other things, it's not that particularly strong in terms of loyalty right now. So even though people who have a club card have a reason to go back to Tesco because they'll get points on it, and then they can use those points to buy more things that are cheaper and so on. The trouble is, well, apart from the discounters, nearly everyone has these damn loyalty cards. So there's not a particularly compelling reason to go back unless it's price. And in order to try and get your price down, one thing you need to try and do is get your rent down. Because Tesco's and Sainsbury's and others, if we know one thing at all about retailing, it's that margins ain't big. And you can't really squeeze in much like that to try and bring your prices down. So you need to try and get your costs down somehow. And the way they're attempting to do it is try and take ownership of their own stores, get the rent off the cost list and try and pass some of that through to customers. So Sainsbury's had a big old buy of some of their portfolio and now they own them and this company doesn't. But if you're selling them, if you're trading at a discount to NAV and you're selling your stuff at NAV, then your shareholders stand to do all right, to be honest. They're buying shares on the assumption your portfolio is worth X. You're selling it at X plus 20%. This is a good thing. So one possibility here is this trend continues. They sell them off like they have been and you get a 20% upside. Okay, your portfolio shrinks, but you get the 20% boost from selling stuff. They say, by the way, Supermarket Income REIT, that then that's not the plan to sell this stuff down. We will see. There is only finite amounts of space in this country to go building supermarkets everywhere. So stores aren't going to be moving around hugely, and I think they will want to own their own buildings. And if they make a compelling enough offer, I think they would be unwise to turn it down when you have motivated buyers. But let's suppose they don't for the moment then, because they say they're not going to. They're just going to keep chugging along doing what REITs do, which is borrowing money, renting things out, and paying out dividends. Average leases are around 13 years or so. There are inflation uplifts built into pretty much all of them in one way or another. There's a 7.5% dividend. It keeps going up for the time being. It got a boost recently from that sell-off. And that was returned, I think, to shareholders, or I thought I was reading that they'd use that to pay it out as a dividend rather than tackling debt or anything like that. But in general, 13-year leases and the debt seems to have a reasonably long time to run for the moment. So I wonder whether this might be a nice opportunity here. On the one hand, if stuff gets sold off, well, you're trading below NAV here, and that means that you stand to benefit if they sell them at anything like the appropriate rates. I don't think they're under any pressure to sell anything at not the appropriate rates either, particularly they're not in concerns over debts and leases and so on. Stuff is well occupied here. And at the moment, you get a 7.5% dividend yield if you buy the stock now. Thoughts, Steve?
So I don't really know an awful lot about this stock, but I've been reading the report as you've been talking to Steve, and it's actually a really nice little annual report that they put out. A lot of REITs put no effort into their annual report, and they make you sort of like hunting down, you know, just the headline stats, really, really difficult to see. But here, it's quite nicely laid out. I mean, the just three or four pages in, you've got the headline stats here that there's apparently an 8.2% yield at the moment, 6p dividend per share, but their adjusted EPS is only 5.8p. So that must be coming somewhere. Some of that must be coming out of that sale. 14 years on the WALT portfolio. Interesting stat, really, Steve. And then, like I say, you go through the report. They do a really good job of laying out, you know, how well they're doing. And they seem to be doing pretty well. It looks like kind of what we've seen a lot with REITs across the world, really, is that they've just been beaten. They've all been beaten the same. There's been no kind of nuance to the beatings. People have just took sort of one look at them and gone, these people probably have a lot of debt. Therefore, we should beat them. And this is another one of those where you're looking at that list of supermarket exposure, 49% exposed to Tesco. I don't think there's going to be a problem there. 30% exposed to Sainsbury's again. I don't think there's going to be a problem there. And then it's essentially single digit Morrisons, Waitrose, Asda, Aldi, M&S and Iceland. Mm. All of those supermarkets to me seem like they're doing perfectly well. So, you know, providing that you can collect that dividend and they can keep a steady price, which again, is a very difficult time to judge a REIT. If you just pull that five-year chart up, I assume it is down, Steve. But that's probably not the best time to judge it because REITs are going through a very sticky period at the moment. So we're talking about from here on, if this can achieve meager growth and you collect the dividend, you've got a market beating performance straight off the bat here. And it doesn't have to grow very much if it can keep that dividend going.
Growth is always the issue for REITs, and partly that's structural, because if you're busy dividending out all your money, we mentioned this earlier in the Berkshire thing, then you're not using it to fund growth, which means if you want to grow, you have to try and find that from somewhere else. So either get your shareholders to pay for it by issuing equity, or get someone else to pay for it by taking debt, and then you have to pay them back again. I think with REITs in general, and I think it's especially true here, in a case where the kind of size of available property or the available properties market is shrinking as supermarkets take into their own kind of or buy things into their own umbrella and want to own their buildings, I think growth is going to be extra kind of difficult here. Not enough stuff let to Heron Foods, by the way, so that might be an area that they want to kind of think about. I suspect that's because B&M tends to own its own stores, by the way. We talked about them picking up former Wilko things. My suspicion is that that's going to mean they do own their things. That's why they trade it, or they offer better value. But yeah, I think with this kind of stock, you probably want to buy this at a level where you think, I'm not that worried about growth. Would I take 7.5% from here out? Maybe. It's not a terrible return. FTSE 100 averages 6.25 on over the last 20 odd years. So you will, if things remain the same, beat it like that. If 7.5% isn't considered a win here, I would think twice about buying this. But I'm okay with taking it at those levels, I think, and just taking the cash that kind of comes in. I think when you think about it that way, you'll get some, I should say 7.5%, that's inflation linked as well. So you will get a push in line with inflation on that. So you won't, if the concern was 7.5 is fine, but inflation is at 5, and that's going to get chipped away quite quickly. And don't worry about that concern, at least for the moment. Worry more about, are they going to be able to grow their portfolio? Don't know. Are they going to be able to extract higher rents out of companies? Maybe. But I don't think they're going to be able to suddenly start charging Tesco three times as much or something like that, because that's where a lot of their portfolio is. And Tesco will know that too.
Yeah, there's an element of protection here. They are a small company dealing with monsters, aren't they? So long as they keep up their side of the bag, and they'll, you know, Tesco will continue to to pay the bill. Yeah, interesting looking stock, this one, Steve. Not one I've really looked at. Is this one that you're buying or looking at buying or still
one
considering?
I
or
own as of earlier this week. I decided to jump in with 100 or so quid as worth, which is 5,000 share. No, the share price is just under a quid or so. So I'm into triple digits. I own about 120 shares or so, which is not a lot, but I am seriously thinking about potentially growing this one out a bit. The issue I have is the same issue you had with Adyen, which brings a sort of full circle of, I like this REIT. I quite like a lot of REITs. I'm tempted to try and buy a sort of, I don't want to say diversified bunch of REITs, because that sounds like a contradiction, because they're all REITs. You can't have diversified stuff that's all in the same country and in the same industry and then start calling it diversified. I get annoyed enough when people talk about diversification just across industries. But yeah, I like it. I've grabbed a bit of it, and next week I shall talk about another REIT that I've found that is even smaller than this one, and you will like that even more, because that is a diversified REIT, if such a thing exists.
Fair enough. I think I've been quite REIT heavy as well at the moment, but I've stuck to my US REITs. I haven't yet ventured into UK REITs. They're all quite small in the UK, and the one that I really wanted to buy just a few months ago was Segro, but like I explained to you, Steve, I've since discovered that that stands for Slough Estates Group, and I will never buy it now.
It's exciting, that, isn't it? Slough Estates Group, yeah. Anything that's not headquartered in Hull, or at least has some sort of, if you've got like not Hull in the name, then it's never really going to be, well, any kind of success as a business at all. To be honest,
for somebody who's read a lot of Peter Lynch, Steve, and he told me to go and explore my locality and see what kind of business is that. It's very easy for me in Hull, Steve, because everything is in Hull, so I get to buy every company I want to.
Pretty much. There's a Wetherspoons there as well, I imagine. We can talk about those a bit further down the line. They're part of the inspiration for this idea, actually. I was hearing that they're doing the supermarket thing, as I am calling it, or the supermarkets are doing their thing, which is being, we can't keep charging low prices or get to charging low prices in the case of supermarkets while we're constantly smashing out lease payments to everybody. So we need to dump some of these leasehold things, buy out freeholds where we can. And if we can't, get rid of them, and that will help us keep our prices down. That's the kind of Spoons model, and you can see it coming across to stuff like Sainsbury's, who are realizing we're paying too much here in leases. We're going to have to take some cash. We're going to have to stick it into buying these buildings. But at least once we've done that, we can then start to try and compete on price, because we kind of have to compete on price with the discounters. I had a lot of time to think about this while I was sat for 20 minutes collecting a Sainsbury's order this morning.
Then there's no investment into those buildings once they go out to your real estate partners either, is there? They'll be like, you want the shell, you pay for the shell.
Everything
else in there is kind of defeats the object, really, I think, of really doing these buildings up and doing the car parks up and things like that. If you still then go and pay rent to somebody else, I think it's always feels a lot sweeter when they when you own the building and you do the work to it.
Well, that was our show. Thank you all very much for listening. That was the latest installment of Steve Does REIT. More on that next week. More from Steve D, more from me, and we will see you all same time next Sunday.